Okay, we will make a start for this Hollow Blitz seminar. I'm Councillor Cathy Oak. It's a bit echoey here. I don't know if it's echoey for you, but Councillor Cathy Oak from the City of Melbourne. I chair the Environment Portfolio. And before I begin, I would like to acknowledge that we are meeting here this evening on the traditional land of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to elders both past and present. We will certainly be hearing more about the use of and the incorporation of and the respect of Indigenous knowledge, Aboriginal knowledge in our biodiversity work here at the City of Melbourne and also Aboriginal knowledge further. It's something that is very important to the City of Melbourne in looking to apply caring for country principles in our approach to sustainability. And I think that we'll learn a lot from, particularly from Dean this evening, about how we can do that even further. I would like to thank you for coming along to this seminar blitz. I was just talking to Ian Shears, Manager of Sustainability, about, I don't know, it feels like 100 years ago, but in 2009, almost 10 years ago, we held our first seminar on the urban forest strategy. We were told that no one would turn up and why we were running a workshop on the urban forest strategy, but we proved them wrong, Ian, and over 100 people turned up and were, you know, to learn about, you know, at that point, what we knew about trees. And we know a whole lot more about trees, but we're very pleasantly surprised, and no short thanks to our urban ecology team with Rod and Lee and others in turning in encouraging a full house of people to come and hear about biodiversity in the city. And, you know, I'm sure that if this was proposed, you know, in 2009, that would also tell us this is not something that people are going to be interested in at all. But again, you've proved them wrong. We know that people in our city, visitors to our city, people who live, people who work in our city are very interested and connected to nature in their community and want to know what the city is doing about protecting and enhancing and understanding. And, you know, and tonight is certainly one of the ways that we let you know what we're doing around urban sustainability and biodiversity in the city. But it's also an opportunity to hear from an amazing group of experts, and in particular on this topic around hollows and birds and how we can know more about the birds in our city and the birds that use our trees and how we can make sure that we're managing our urban forest accordingly. I'm incredibly excited to have such an amazing panel of presenters, and I'm sure that you'll really enjoy the seminar that I acknowledge Lee has put together, a really nice story, you know, understanding why birds are important and what do we know about birds in our city, understanding more about Indigenous and Aboriginal knowledge around birds in the city as well, hearing what the city is doing around urban forestry and urban ecology, and then hearing what else about biodiversity should we know about, what do we know about, and what are the next steps that the city should be taking when we're looking to roll out our nature and the city strategy, which is a recently launched document, but obviously it is a culmination, I hate that word. It's it brings together a lot of information around biodiversity that we've been gathering over a long time. So that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be hearing from a lot of speakers. You will have an opportunity, if we all stick to time, to ask questions after each of the presenters. And then if there is more time at the end, we will, you know, allow some more time for conversation. But we're very aware that you've come out on your evening, and we want to make sure that you get home at the time that we said you'd get home, and so that the event will finish before 8 o'clock. There will be an opportunity to have some more refreshments at the end and talk to not only the experts, but also, you know, understand why you're here and talk to the fellow audience members about why you've come out to an event about birds and hollows in the City of Melbourne. So that's the process. I think that I'll be able to run the slideshow over here, otherwise I'll let the experts do that as well. So without further ado, I think we will start this really exciting conversation. Actually, before I begin, I would like to know who actually took part in one of the hollow blitzes over the weekend. It was on Sunday and Monday. Who took part? Nice. And who's going to take part in a future one? Yeah, there you go. That's exciting. I know Lee said to me, well, we had 72 people take part on Sunday and Monday, which is pretty cool, but she wants more. So make sure that you invite your friends and your family and make sure they all know about the Eventbrite site. And I'm sure we'll be plugging it further this evening if you don't know how to sign up. I'm not a big fan of being close to birds. I love birds. They're beautiful. But when they're near me, I get kind of scared. I'm not phobic, but it's not more. I'm a zoology student as well, but that, I don't know, I'm scared of breaking them and I'm scared of them swooping at me and all of this. But I was quite proud that I went out to Royal Park where I know that they swoop, and we looked and we found some beautiful birds in the hollows, and Lee shared some photos of the galahs in the hollows and the eucalypts, and so very beautiful photos of the birds. And so the Hollow Blitz is all about understanding more about that, and so great that you're involved already or look to be involved in future events. Very important. So I'm going to ask our first speaker, Dr. Karen Herman, to come and talk about birds, birds in Australia and birds in Melbourne. Karen is a research ecologist with BirdLife Australia. This is Australia's longest running conservation organisation. Karen's been working in conservation since completing her PhD in 2005 at the University of Tasmania. And she works across a range of projects with BirdLife Australia, with an emphasis on urban bird projects around Metro Melbourne. You can teach me to like birds more. BirdLife Australia are in the development phase of an urban bird program within the organisation, and I'm sure that the City of Melbourne will be working with you closely on that. So you're going to talk about birds in the burbs, how birds bring joy to urban residents, and why we need to protect their habitats.
Can I just arrow?
Yes.
Right. Sorry, we didn't go through the technical details. I like a bit of alliteration, so birds in the bird, it's always good. And I'll just share my why I love birds story. So I've been out in the field from Monday today, so if I sound a bit vague, it's because I've been up since 4 o'clock in the morning the last 3 days doing bird surveys in Tallangi. I love it. We were sitting out there today just under a tree, and eastern spinebills come in, and you get them, and they're flying around your head, and fantails, and to me, birds are an indication that I'm a part of something bigger. I love this notion of being out in the bush, and the world is not just about me as a person in my little urban environment, but we're actually part of a bigger system and a bigger environment, and I think that's really, really important. So I'm going to sort of talk about that to some degree, and then have a look at what birds we see in Melbourne, the hollow nesting species that are the target or the focus of the Hollow Blitz. And then hopefully you guys will get really, really excited and go out and look for more, not just during the Hollow Blitz, but actually look out for more birds while you're wandering around the cities, and maybe even put stuff in your own backyard to attract them into it. So 85% of our population live in urban environments of Australia. That's a huge number of people in a very small area of the country. And especially down our eastern seaboard, there are really specific bird species that we find, or we used to find, in those habitats that our cities are now covering. So we're altering the landscape and we're altering the habitats, and we're seeing changes in the bird diversities and which species are there or no longer present in some of these spaces. And in doing that, and in that process, we're actually starting to distance ourselves from the environment and from nature. But there's an increasing body of literature and an interest in the benefits that we have as people with engaging with green space and engaging with nature itself. And I think birds are a really great species, because you can see them, and everyone has a bird story. And I can guarantee that at the end of this, if you turn to someone that you don't know, you will both be able to bond over your bird stories, whether it's a species that you both love, or whether it's an experience that you've had, or whether it's a magpie swooping you and a fear of birds but still getting out there and doing it. You'll all find that you've got something in common around birds. And I find this because working as a bird ecologist or a bird researcher, I'm kind of a safe person for people to tell me their stories. Like that dagginess or that kind of nerdy or geekiness that goes with birds, and that perception of a strange man with binoculars and a trench coat, they start to talk to me and it's like, oh, actually, it's okay. And people who do love birds don't look like that. And they start to engage it. Everyone has a story. I've had a guy who was a furniture removalist tell me he knew nothing about birds, and within 5 minutes of speaking to me, he was then telling me how he liked to go out to the park and watch the Rosellas. So everyone can engage with each other over birds and can engage with the environment. So there are benefits. And I might just be a little bit biased because I have the privilege of spending my time with these critters for a job. But increasingly we're seeing in the literature studies around the benefits for our well-being and our mental health to green space in the environment. And specifically, people are starting to look at birds. And urban bird feeding, people are finding that there's, the research is finding that there's actually significant mental health benefits when people go out and feed the birds. The Doses of Neighbourhood Nature, that paper refers to a study that was done in the UK where they looked at people's engagement and statistically significant differences in people's feeling of well-being and happiness and contentment in life were found dependent on the number of birds they saw on their way home from work in the afternoon. So there actually seems to be a real tangible benefit to encountering birds in our environments. And if we can improve our urban habitats to keep these species in there, there's got to be benefits to us. And the really cool thing about this is that we're seeing not just the scientific literature, but the mainstream media picking up on this as well. So the message reaches a wider audience. It's not just me sitting in my office trawling through literature that finds these things. It's someone who picks up, I think there's the Sydney Morning Herald or the UK in the Telegraph or these other web pages that are actually picking up this message and passing it on to people that birds are actually good for us. Watching garden birds is good for your mental health, research shows. So hopefully there's an increase in engagement in that audience. So this is just a bit of a slide to actually show how engaged people generally already are with birds. We have an urban bird program predominantly run out of Sydney, has been running for about 10 years called Birds in Backyards. So we have people, we survey those guys. And you can see that which are the green and the purple are just the general public. Even high percentages of people within the general public are aware that bird species are decreasing. They're aware that, or to what degree does your personal well-being depend on the natural world? So many people who aren't specifically engaged with us and with birds are actually already aware and saying that this is really important to them. So it's something I think that we really need to start looking at how we engage and improve our environment for that. So hopefully these will work. Ooh.
Do I have to hit play?
This is the guy that I was watching today sit down about 3 metres from my head and watch him. So for people who don't know, this is an eastern spinebill, not a hollow nesting species. But quite common in suburbia. Background music. They're very cool little birds, and they're a species that I'm quite focused on as using as an engagement or as a mascot species for urban work. How many people have actually seen or have seen this species before? It's not a very wide set. Look at that. Awesome. So we've got some superb fairy wrens. In urban spaces, these guys are a bit of a worry for me because we see them along creek lines and we see them along retained corridoring, but we don't tend to see them away from those corridors anymore. They used to be quite prolific in people's backyards, but we're actually starting to see that, anecdotally at least, there's not been any extensive research on it, but they're actually starting to disappear from the spaces between those green corridors in the cities. So do you feel better now having watched that? A bit more relaxed? So now I'll just kind of move on to what we're seeing in urban spaces. So this is an aerial photo of Melbourne. A lot of green space there around the Yarra and the park. There's also a lot of concrete. There's a lot of tree canopy, but there's not a lot of understory in that. Then as you get out further into other areas of suburbia, again, you see that there's quite a bit of tree canopy and tree cover and houses and roads, but it's quite a uniform environment. And then I really like this one from a hot air balloon. And again, it just shows you that same, that we have these corridors of trees with houses in between. So we have a very altered landscape if you were to look over an aerial photo of a forest or a woodland, which will be green trees and structured habitat. So we have roofs and we have roadways. So where are we heading now with our urban environments? Because backyards and urban green spaces are becoming quite important refuges for biodiversity. This is what we like to think historic Melbourne looked like, but you'll notice there's auto bins, so the picture has been black and white, it's not actually aged. But there's like these big, lush, established gardens with shrubs and hedgerows and tussocks and structure and various shapes of trees and plants. And then some of our inner city areas, really close together and no front yards and very small backyards. And unfortunately, this is kind of where we're heading in some of our outer or more suburban areas. A house, some grass, if you're lucky it's real grass these days, sometimes it's artificial turf, and maybe a tree or two, because it's low maintenance and people are busy and they don't have a lot of time. And we see some of these planning of you know, what would have once been someone's backyard is now four or five houses. So the space that's actually available for species outside of people is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So we have to start thinking about how we actually use that in a way that is beneficial to biodiversity. So this is where you need to learn to meet your neighbours so you can plan together around your little courtyards how to increase your habitat within a small space. And something like that can be achieved in you know, if areas and developments are well planned. So park space, roadways, backyards are all really quite important for things other than ourselves. And if we want to keep the birds in the landscape that we know are beneficial to us, then we need to start thinking about how we're going to do that. And one of the things that this is specifically about is hollows. So I've got some pictures of some hollows there, and I've got some really cool pictures of purple-crowned lorikeets using hollows. Has anyone ever seen a purple-crowned lorikeet? Has anyone ever heard of a purple-crowned lorikeet before now? There's a few yeses. So they're a really small little parrot. They're not an urban resident. You'll see them in Westgate Park and maybe in Royal Park, but they'll fly over the top making a really high-pitched noise. So they're like a really fast rainbow lorikeet, but much smaller. So across Australia, about 15% of all fauna, not just birds, but mammals, possibly reptiles, we don't know, utilise or are dependent on tree hollows. So we have 114 species of birds that are what we call obligate hollow users. That is that they only nest in tree hollows. So if you actually change your definition of what hollow use is, that number will increase. Because there are species like scarlet robins, or in this picture, this is a nest of a dusky wood swallow, who, if there's a nest or a hollow space, they'll possibly utilise, but they can also build nests in other ways. So they're what we refer to as facultative hollow users. But the main ones that you guys probably will know are parrots and cockatoos. So this is where we get to look at good, pretty bird pictures, because that's the fun part. Do you all recognise these guys? Do you all love or hate these guys? Who loves them all? Who loves some of them and not all of them? Honest, I like that. Is there anyone who doesn't like any of them? All right, I have to speed up. Sorry, I talked too much. So rainbow lorikeets, really, really abundant across the city of Melbourne. Amazingly vibrant parrot. And if you're ever down on the Yarra on a weekend, you'll see the tourists just absolutely mesmerised by these birds. So I'm going to flick through this because I've got 5 minutes. Other species that you may not see or may not know quite so well, so little grass parrots like blue-winged parrots, musk lorikeets, and eastern rosellas. These guys need hollows to nest in, and what we're finding with some of the results for the hollow blitz is that they'll actually use elm trees and they don't just need native eucalypt species. Kookaburras and kingfishers. Did anyone here know that a kookaburra, like, you don't think of kookaburras as a hollow nester? We see them and they're such an iconic Australian bird, but they're so dependent on these resources that are disappearing. And work that we're actually doing in BirdLife is showing that these common birds are actually declining across Australia or the eastern seaboard. We'll skip through that. Powerful owls. We get powerful owls in the centre of Melbourne. Massive big owls in the middle of Melbourne in Flagstaff Gardens and in Fitzroy Gardens and the Botanic Gardens. The smaller boobooks and the kestrels. There's numbers of pairs of kestrels that nest around the city. So they're things that are trying to hang on and live with us in urban spaces. So let's kind of try and improve the habitat and give them a better chance. Ducks, numerous species of ducks, scarlet robins, white-browed tree creepers. And sometimes when natural tree hollows aren't available, birds will make do with whatever they can find. So we have here a spotted pardalote just hanging out in someone's watering. I hope they didn't keep watering because that nest wouldn't have been very successful. And then I won't stay here very quick because they're introduced species. Quickly, hollow formation is a really slow process. It takes over 100 years for a tree to develop hollows. The problem with that is in urban spaces, particularly with eucalypt trees, is that old trees are a hazard. And we don't like old trees in our urban spaces because they can be a safety risk. And other guys later will talk a bit more of this, but there are things that you can do in your immediate environment to help that. Nest boxes are an option. Tree guards around bases that help birds and exclude possums might help. And they can be in really quite interesting places. So this is an eastern rosella nest box in Sydney. You can actually see from the picture here that it's being utilised. So there's ways that we can actually start thinking about our environment, our urban environment, and improve habitat or improve the resources for our birds, because it's all good that they've got open spaces for foraging, but if they're not nesting, they're not going to stay. And I've run out of time, and I feel like I've just rushed through all that because I like my birds. So, sorry.
That quickly, Karen. Sorry, but don't trip up. Sorry. There is time for questions.
You told me it's just like 5 minutes. 5 minutes.
That's so that we could all ask you some questions, because I'm sure that we all have them. I've got a couple, but let's see if the audience have any questions for Karen. Can't see
nothing.
Out there.
Silence.
There you go.
What's your favourite urban bird?
Do you want to speak into the microphone?
Favourite urban bird.
See, I get really excited because I had red-rumped parrots turn up on my balcony. I have budgies, I have pet budgies, and I know that some people may see a contradiction between bird ecologist and budgerigar pet keeper. But they are purely aviary-born, and it's really cool because I had them sitting out on the balcony, and these two male wild red-rumped parrots came in and landed on top of the budgie cage and had a chat to the budgies. And I watch the budgies in the mornings because they go outside and the rainbow lorikeets will fly over and squawk and squawk and squawk. The budgies are like, ah, we're here, come and say hello. So probably my favourite urban, now I'm thinking about it more. And Willy Wagtails is another one. I get excited about Willy Wagtails because they're disappearing as well. And so when I see them, I get really excited that they're still there. Yes. Well,
did everyone hear the question, just out of interest?
So the question was about artificially feeding birds. So that study is a US study, and there's a very different perception, or there's a very different culture in bird feeding in the US and the UK compared to here. We don't at BirdLife advocate that people feed birds.
because of those issues, that there are nutritional issues and there are potentially health issues, and then there are, because we do have species that are seasonal migrants, so they need to migrate. And I have a great story about the extremes of that, but I don't have time. If I'm here later, ask. So we do need to be very careful if you are feeding birds, what you're feeding them and how you feed them. We don't like to sort of give a blanket ban of don't do it, because sometimes that's the best way to engage people, is for them to actually start to love the birds that come into their garden, and then they start to look at the bigger picture about how I keep them in my environment. So what we advocate is actually looking at plants that you can plant that will feed them and give them a more natural diet than seed and bread. Bread is, don't ever feed birds bread. Just blanket ban on bread for birds. So it is better to try and give them a more natural food. But we do live in a very modified landscape as well, and some of that maybe we need to give a little bit of wiggle room, because we do live in an urban environment. Some of those processes have already been changed.
Such a great question and an excellent answer. I love it. Learning stuff. We just have one more time for one more question. Hold them up. Save your questions to the end too. Thanks, David.
Is there an Indian miner control program? Because I believe that they will control nest hollows by stuffing them with rubbish just so they can control the territory.
I don't know if City of Melbourne have a miner control policy.
I was just thinking, is someone writing these questions down?
My answer to that is, it's the science is actually still out on how much of a major issue they are. There seems to be, from some of the stuff I've been looking at, the data I've been looking at in urban spaces, and I'm only talking about in urban spaces, is you kind of get a flush of miners through, and that first front has a huge effect on the native birds. But after a while, their numbers drop down and stuff starts to come back. So you start to reach another equilibrium. But I mean, there's no denying that there's an effect of these introduced species and the common or the Indian miner on native species. And I have to admit, I've got a bit of respect for them, because they are really, really smart birds. So I was talking to one of the officers out at Manningham Council Manningham do run a control and provide support for miner control. She was telling me the process that you have to go through to set miner traps. You need to do it in dark so they don't see you. You need to do it quietly so they don't hear you. And you have to set it up. Once you catch them maybe one or two nights, you have to move the trap because the birds won't come back, because they're so smart. And they're from a distribution, they have invaded worldwide. So there's got to be something there that has enabled them to invade. So as much as I see the ecological conflict, there's a bit of respect for them as well, because they're really smart birds.
I think a lot of natural resource management, urban environment conservation programs is all about the similarly complex decision process for a range of our programs have to go on. So I don't, the conflict that you're articulating is something that our urban ecology team.
I'm sort of starting to come to a point where I'm thinking, we've modified the landscape anyway. Maybe we just try and enhance it, and it might be a little bit controversial to say that. I don't know. Is that we're never going to get everything back that was here. So how about we try and improve what we've got to keep what we've got here? And maybe we need to accept that miners and sparrows and pigeons, which people hate, are a part of that landscape. And pigeons provide food for the peregrine falcons and the collared sparrowhawks that predate on them over the Vic markets. So they kind of have a role in the ecological systems that are starting to establish themselves. So I don't know if it's an easy answer.
Think about whether you think that's controversial or not, and store it up for the discussion at the end, or let us know, obviously, through other means. But thank Karen once again, please. Thank you. Managed to get it to work, that's always good. Our next presenter is Dean Stewart, and Dean has worked for over 20 years within management roles in both environmental and cultural organisations. Dean's worked for almost 10 years as the Community Revegetation Project Coordinator for Eltham and then Nillumbik Councils. You've worked with the City of Melbourne on the Indigenous Walks as part of our BioBlitz, And you're currently working on a nest box program proposal with Hobsons Bay Council and also on eco projects, The Lost Lands Found, Reclaiming Victoria's Flowering Grasslands and Healing Country, Heal Ourselves. So tonight, Dean is going to give us an Indigenous perspective on tree hollows and wildlife. So come up, please.
G'day, you mob. So I need to start off with the ancient Kulin words of greeting, Wemenjika. But we're talking about trees and tree hollows and everything, so I'd probably just be a bit provocative, just want to give a big high five to the plane trees that are out there at the moment and our closed up throats and congestion and all the rest of it to those introduced trees. But where we are now in this, fluorescent lit building, I just want to acknowledge the First Nations people of this area, the Bun Wurrung and the Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation, whose ancestral lands we're on today as well. Look, we're all sharing in this today as a clan group. People and community have been coming to this place to share knowledge and to share stories for over 60,000 years. So I wonder if you could all lend your voice and repeat after me and say, Wemenjika.
Yeah?
Can you say, Bunwarang?
Woi
Wurrung. Can you say, Kulin? Guys, the words that you just articulated then are the names, the families and friends that have lived right where we're sitting now, the place that we call home for 60,000 years. Guys, you've got to realise the place that you're going home to tonight to have your meal, this place was black for 60,000 years, except for the last 200 as well. People and community have been here for thousands and thousands of years. My mob are Wamba, Wamba and Wagaya, up on the Murray River. I've been down here for decades, basically. I set up and was running all the revegetation programs from Eltham up to King Lake, from Plenty River across to the Bend of Isles for many, many years and loved all that. And for me as an Aboriginal fella, getting my hands in the earth every single day with the dirt underneath my fingernails was a real connection for me. And it was very easy for me to go from the natural heritage to go to the cultural heritage. I did that for many years and then I set up the Aboriginal Heritage Walks in the Royal Botanical Gardens in Melbourne over 15 years ago. They're still running today, which is awesome. Then I did a stint as a manager in education and then I set up my own business, A-Team. Aboriginal Tours and Education Melbourne. So every year through the middle of Melbourne, I run probably about 15,000 people on my walks every year, right through Crown Casino Plaza and things like that as well. I'm doing lots of other projects, some of them we just mentioned before, and we can chat about that later on as well at the same time. Not only do I want to acknowledge the Bun Wurrung and Woi Wurrung, but the elders of the place, but I also want to acknowledge the Muruk, or the spirit that binds and connects every single one of us. I also need to acknowledge all those that have gone before us, our ancestors, and every single one of us sitting here have got ancestors that help guide us through our lives. And I need to acknowledge the land, the place that nurtures us, the place that supports us, and the place that we all today call home as well. I actually just want to sort of paint a little bit of a picture for you and read out something from a white fella about 100, 150 years ago of where we are right now. And he goes, the site and surrounding of the embryonic city, when in a state of nature, formed a picture of wild and wayward beauty. The eastern hill was a gum and wattle tree forest, and the western hill was so clothed with she-oaks as to give the appearance of a primeval park where timber cutting and tree felling were unknown. whilst away northwards, as far as the eye could see, was country undulating, garbed with a vestige of soft green grass. As a herbage, it luxuriated everywhere, and two persons still living who walked through unstreeted Melbourne in 1836 have informed me that the places that are now known as Collins, Burke, Elizabeth and Swanston, they waded through grass as green as leek and nearly breast high. The blacks, the emus, the bellbirds, parrots and magpies had the northern quarter all to themselves, for the kangaroos most affected the southern side of the river, satisfied with the immense scampering areas afforded them. On the waters of the large marsh lying between North Melbourne and Saltwater River, graceful swans, pelicans, geese, black, brown and grey ducks, lots of birds, teal and cormorants disported themselves, while curlews, spurwing plover, cranes, snipe and quail either waded around the shallows or ran along its margins. Eels, trout and small species of perch and almost innumerable green frogs inhabited its waters. And the last named, on warm nights, held a regular serenade that could be heard over a greater part of the town. Imagine being on an evening after we walk out of here and hear a serenade of the green frogs from West Melbourne wetlands that used to be here as well. Imagine what this place used to be like as well. Now, how's this work again? Oh, there we go. So again, on the Kulin lands, you can see where we are in the Bunwurrung and Woiwurrung country just there as well. Talking about animals before, we're on Bunzel's country. This is Bunzel, not the big white parrot on the Rungeri Way. The great creator, the god of this entire region. So we might be in the city, but we're very much in Bunzel's country as well. And this is the mob of the place. And this is what used to be right around here as well. The Willem, the home. And this, you can see that the women are doing all the work, by the way, in these images as well. Primarily the western districts with all the amazing volcanic grasslands and all the food through those areas, collecting our evening food right now as well. But this is what this place used to be like. This is Melbourne from Crown Casino, looking across to where the aquarium is near Enterprise Park, Melbourne, 1836 as well. Look at the forest running through there. Think about all the hollows, yeah? Now it's a forest of apartment buildings and skyscrapers today as well. This is sort of where I run most of my walks through the area through here. And this is a little pet project that I completed just a little while ago with the assistance of Eco Centre Land, once as it was, which I amalgamed sort of several different early colonial maps of the inner Melbourne area to give a sense of what the area used to be like. I'm actually working on a huge project with the University of Melbourne and the School of Geography at the moment to make a massive multi-dimensional digital education tool that'll go to every primary and secondary school, where they can strip away levels of their landscape so they can see where they played footy on the weekend and then go to the map and see the wetlands that used to be there and things like that. So we're just in the start of that process now as well. But you can see where we are up there. You've got beautiful West Melbourne wetlands there, and the south side, what I call the temperate Kakadu. An amazing amount of wetlands running through that entire region as well. There were magpie geese here. There were brolga right here as well. Amazing stuff. Anybody know where the last surviving remnant of those amazing wetlands is still existing in inner Melbourne today? The largest remnant? Sorry? No, much closer than that. Year nines, anybody? Guys, the Formula One cars drive around it. Albert Park is a prehistoric wetland, the last left of the entire temperate Kakadu that cover the entire western, southern side of our city as well. But the areas here again, 1836, and this is one of the maps that I use, the fantastic 1837 Hoddle map, done only 2 years after the very first white people set foot here. And I don't know how that light is, but you can see the extent of the wet, the forest running right through what we now call the CBD of Melbourne. Yeah? What happened to all those trees? Firewood. Chopped down for fence posts and firewood. But as we were just talking about, imagine what they meant to the koalas, the boobook owls, the tawny frogmouth, the native bees as well, all gone. So when a lot of people come on my walks, they're doing Australian studies, so they're using words like colonisation, English settlement, European occupation. The word that I always use is cultural tsunami. Cultural tsunami. This huge wave of change that rolled over not just the people, but the place as well. So let's go to Melbourne, 1836, and then go from 1837 to only a year later, Melbourne, 1838. And let's go from Melbourne, 1838, to only 15 years after the start of the gold rush, which was in 1851. So the turning basin just here, and let's go from 1838, 15 years after the gold rush, to exactly the same spot, that cultural tsunami. Massive, massive change. Guys, if gold had never been discovered, as an Aboriginal fella, I'd be talking very differently, but imagine what it meant to all the animals within the area as well. Melbourne, same area, that's South Melbourne Town Hall now, in 1855, just there as well. Massive, massive changes as well to people, to place, to country, to culture as well. Just to help you out, to put it into perspective here, my mob are up the top there. Wamba Wamba is my father country, Wagaya is my Aboriginal grandparents. But I, as I said, I've been in Melbourne doing cultural education and everything for a million years, it seems. And for those that don't know, the map of Aboriginal Australia, you're looking at about 450 completely separate Aboriginal languages in Australia today as well. Going back to hollows, yeah, so we've got all the possums and all that type of stuff. Basically, because they're nocturnal, it's basically meat on a stick. Yeah, you just go out during the day and you can collect as much as you want. And the hollow is incredibly important. The meat was a great source of protein. The bones were used for your bling and your jewellery and your small, fine tools. And of course, the possum skin cloaks, the Wallat guns were incredibly important as well. And all of our elders had our possum skin, our possum skin cloaks, like your mayor just there as well. And here's our mob, yeah? Possum skin project that was done, I use another term, the Aboriginal Renaissance. As Aboriginal people, we are rediscovering and reinterpreting our connections to country, and the use of the possum skin cloaks again as part of our traditional millennia-old culture in a new way is incredibly important. And there's all the local mob there as well. I'm catching up with that one, just Carolyn there tomorrow for lunch. We've got the scar trees, which are an important part of the trees for marking places, men's, women's business, boundary lines, all those type of things as well. But another really important one is traditionally in many areas throughout Victoria, it'd be a place of the last resting place for our family as well. And this is a great example in the early 2000s of the Jarrah baby. That was specially put into a hollow, was wrapped up in a possum skin cloak and had 130 different artefacts of both Aboriginal and European all wrapped up as part of the possessions into the next life. When they chopped the tree down in 1900, it fell out of the tree. They gave it to the Museum Victoria, and the young little kid there basically was on a metal shelf for almost 100 years. It was given back to the Aboriginal community, and they put it back in a hollow in a tree for the Djarrarung people as well. So it's well beyond just for the animals as well as for our people. Here's a picture of the Paris end of Collins Street for you in about 1844. Look at the big old River Red Gum trees through there as well. And then I do walks in St Kilda as well, next to one of the oldest living organisms in the whole of this entire place that we now call the second largest capital city in Australia, the Nagi tree or the corroboree tree, which is literally a foot and a half away from the junction of about five freeways running into each other as well. That old grandfather there was on that spot before there was a concept of a white man on this entire region. This tree was there and is still surviving when the Western world thought that the world was flat as well. This tree is a great survivor and it's still here today. You know what? I wish this old grandfather could talk. Imagine the songs and stories it would be able to tell us as well. And most of the old trees are gone, and with that, the hollows that we were talking about before as well. My family, yeah, the Stuarts, and the next line of Stuarts. Yeah? The Doctor Who Trekkie nerd, the homie, and the little scallywag just there as well. Guys, I just want to finish off. I know I've run over time, but I just want to read out something to you, Mob, before I get off. You've all heard about reconciliation. One of my little sayings that I made a point to put in my little thing here. For me, reconciliation is not just about black and white, but it is a reconciliation of us as a people to reconcile ourselves with the land. We are all caretakers of the land, which we must honour and respect. And we need to do that for our life, or we do that to our peril. For you know what? It is us who are bound to the earth. The earth is in no way bound to us. It is solely our own responsibility. You know what? It's our imperative. You know what? Are we all not caretakers? Are we all not custodians? We need to continue the legacy of all of our traditional ancestors. We must care for the land and equally the spirit of the land and respect both deeply. Because it's only then that the land will truly be able to care for us as well. We are all caretakers. Family and friends have looked after this place and on this place for 50,000 years. It's our job now as the new caretakers, as the new custodians. And on that note, thank you. Cheers.
Thank you so much, Dean. I think there's, again, lots of food for thought, yeah. We've probably got time for about one or two questions. Front rows, there we go.
The map that you put together, is that available for getting copies?
I think it's still online with the city of Port Phillip, if you're just going to...
Which map? There are a few maps. Which
the once as it was map in.
Yeah, that's great.
Jump into the Port Phillip Council and click in Aboriginal, and I think the digital thing's still there.
Right.
You can always get in touch with me if you've got any other queries or questions.
Yeah.
Time for one more. Do you have? So you're currently conducting tours, like if people wanted to take part in a longer form discussion with Dean, is there a website and?
Not just the Facebook.
Okay.
But, you can provide all the details online or whatever we're going to do.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, and we're very glad that you're involved in what we're doing around urban biodiversity. So I'm sure you'll see Dean again.
Stage left.
Yes, and don't fall down the steps.
Our third speaker tonight is Ian Shears, and he's the manager of, let's see if I put it,
manager of our urban sustainability team here at the City of Melbourne. I'm sure if you've been to many of our events over the many years around urban sustainability, you might have heard from Ian especially talk about our urban forest. Ian is one of Australia's, and actually the world, I know that he has an incredibly important international following of his work in urban landscapes and particularly urban forestry. Has a specialised, or he specialises in horticulture, and for over a decade, as I said already, he's been working on our urban forest work here at the City of Melbourne. And I believe you're going to be talking about, as the slide says, the history of Melbourne's urban forest strategy and what does that mean in our conversation tonight around HoloBlitz. So thank you, Ian.
Good. Thank you, Cathy, and I'd like to acknowledge that we are meeting on the land of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners, and pay my respects to elders past, present and future. And in a sense, I'd also like to recognise Councillor Oak, and we both have been on an extraordinary journey for quite a few years, going back to 2009 with our first conversation, and without the championing and the drive, then we certainly wouldn't be seeing a lot of what we have. So thank you, Councillor Oak. I'll try, and those of you who know me will find it's going to be quite an extraordinary sort of feat for me to speak for 10 minutes and to explain what the urban forest strategy is about, but I'll give it my best shot. And I thought I'd just kick off with this slide, and really what it is to me what encapsulates it is that what we're looking to do is to have a city in a forest rather than a forest in a city. And we've seen some beautiful images about the transformation of from where we have come from, and I think really what we're all about, and in this room, and it's wonderful to see the sort of the connection and the collection of the community, officers, and our political leaders, because we're the ones that can shape the future. And so it's really incredibly important that we come together and guide, and we have this extraordinary privilege to work out what our vision is for the future city and for the future forest. And I think even over the last sort of decade or so for Melbourne, the conversations that we were having and that we are having now have been absolutely transformed. And we're beginning to transform the city, and I think we can continue to transform the city, and it's really important to do so. You know, we heard from Dean about the tsunami that went through and wiped out a lot of what was there. It's still occurring. If you look at these aerial satellite images, you can see that over time we're still losing a lot of the green. And that densification of our city is increasing all of the time, and that's something that's really concerning for us. So a lot of our work is focusing on how we reverse that loss of greening. And we know that it can be done. If we look at Singapore over the same period of time and you look at that balance between green cover and population growth, you can realise that we can increase population, but we can also increase green cover. So we're doing a lot of work to try and understand how we can clothe our urban setting in green and what that green needs to be. And I've got a couple of bits from the past as well. And focusing on the same spot, you can see here that this is the river crossing. This is the area where we've got the turning basin currently, and you can see that what was a beautiful landscape, and if you notice these eucalypts on the left, they're repeated as we go along, and you can see over a very short period of time that particular sort of euc that's sort of up here on the left tends to tell us about what nature thinks of the way we've settled our city. And so you can see in essence that the challenge that we've got now is that we've built the place that we live in spite of nature. We've turned our back on the power, the potential, all that's there, until we've really sealed off the land. We've separated ourselves from the natural world, and we've got, you know, we've got a very vulnerable city, and I think it impacts on the health and well-being of the community. So from that to that. So that's the same view. So on the right is the space that we're operating now. So how can we go about transforming that to give us back what nature can provide for us? And there's examples around the world, and this is in Seoul, Cheongnyecheong Stream, and that went from several lanes of freeway to that. Now, I had the fortune to walk along that stream 2 weeks ago, and I was imagining what Moonee Ponds Creek could look like, for example. So we can transform the spaces that we're in. High Line in New York is another brilliant example of where there's been extraordinary change in an area by repurposing and rethinking about how we live in our city, and that's a beautiful spot for us. So I've talked about some of the challenges, climate change, etc. So all of these challenges, in essence, led us to develop an urban forest strategy. We did that because of losing potentially what we had, but also because we recognised that if we want to respond to these and to respond to extreme heat events, which are getting worse and worse all the time and killing more people in Australia than anything, then how do we actually go about doing that? And what's the role of nature as our city gets hotter and hotter all the time? And we're also at a point where a lot of our existing trees, we're losing them. And a huge challenge for us is a lot of what we've got around us, and particularly our elms and our beautiful plane trees, are getting up to, you know, 120 plus years old, and we're going to lose what we've got. So now it's a critical time for us to imagine and realise the legacy that we want to leave for future generations. And what can that be? And so a lot of the work that we've been doing is trying to understand how we go from this into something that's a lot more beautiful. The other aspect that's really interesting is that the drive for sort of thinking and what we think about now is across here. So a lot of the ways the city's grown is transforming into thinking about the environmental service provision, what the ecology of the city can be, what it can do. So we've done a lot of work in setting targets, done a lot of analysis, we've brought science in, we've brought in the values of the community, which is incredibly important. We marry the urban forest strategy up with a lot of other work, including recently sort of released Nature in the City strategy. So we're continuing to strategically drive change so we can understand what all the multiple benefits are, whether that's sort of social, whether that's environmental, whether that's economic, and how can we sort of bring it together in a way. And these are the headline principles behind the urban forest strategy. We recognise that change occurs in our city all the time. What we want to do is understand how we can guide that change, and these principles are incredibly important. These are some of the targets which are really important for us, and, you know, as well as sort of increasing canopy cover, it's about diversity, health, it's about urban ecology, and it's about working with the community. And in a sense, the community are one of the most important elements of our forest. How do we transform a city which gives us sort of a heat wave? How do we get lots of beautiful trees? This is a plane tree, Dean, I apologise for that. But it's almost sort of the perfect tree. It's in the middle of the road. Anyway, it's a really good thing. But it transforms our city. Look at the temperature reduction from 30 degrees to 60 degrees outside where the tree isn't there. So as well as the biodiversity, there's a lot of roles. Water plays a really important role in it. But I think I just want to touch really briefly on a few things that the city's doing and how we're going about it. This is Errol Street Reserve. So we've gone from literally a 500 square metre patch to a 5,000 square metre park by peeling back the asphalt. It's our sort of road dieting program, reclaiming the city, going for you know, permeability. Understanding the potential is important. This is work that comes out of our rooftop analysis, where we identified that we can have hectares and hectares of green space. So where do we create the opportunities? What are those opportunities? Where's the habitat? Our Greening Laneways program was highly successful. We did some analysis that identified 170 hectares of green wall space available to be constructed. So understanding the science, the data, gives us the power to engage with the community, working to understand what is here, and then turning this into a children's book so we educate the future generations is incredibly important for us. We're doing a lot of research into understanding what trees are going to be successful into the future. You know, heat temperature increase is going to make a lot of species really vulnerable, and unfortunately some of our endemic trees aren't going to cope into the future. So what do we plant now so we've got trees in 100 years' time? We're trying to embrace greening within the private realm, and our Urban Forest Fund has recently just taken in its first round of applications where we'll partner people to green the private realm. It's incredibly important for us that we think about the city, we think about the governance of the city, and really bring nature to the heart of what we're going to do. So thank you for being part of the journey that the city's on and our community's on, and just you know, enjoy and get into it, and you too can inform the change that we've got. Thanks very much.
Whoa, He took the challenge and he ran with it. We gave him 10 minutes inclusive of questions, and you've actually got time for a couple of questions, Ian. No, I think that our trees, our urban forest, is the most studied forest in the world in any city context, and no short, we should certainly acknowledge Ian for leading the charge. We know more about our forest than anywhere else. But are there any questions within, knowing that we know a lot, have we got any questions for Ian?
Hello, Ian. I'm Jan. I just wonder if you'd be able to incorporate hollows into architecture, like buildings and bridges that animals can live in.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And I think just sort of seeing some of the pictures of the bird boxes really made me realise that we've got a little bit of a challenge, because when we grow a tree in a city, we sort of buy it and we formatively prune it and we care for it so it doesn't form hollows and doesn't form defects, so it doesn't fail. So how do we actually sort of create spaces where we can have those trees that are forming the hollows? What supplementary spaces that can we put in? And I had recently was in the UK having a look through the Olympic Village site. And they actually have bridges designed with hollows within them perfectly, sort of for bats and other birds and things like that. So I think your point is a really good one. We have to think of all of the surfaces just to create the spaces for all of the activities.
Is it getting thought of, is it?
Yeah, look, absolutely. And, we've... basically, I think, we've got some transitioning that we're doing, and certainly I know that we're looking at microbats and things like that, where we have to take trees out where they're currently using them, so we've been putting nesting boxes in there for them. So absolutely, we're creating those opportunities, and I think I'm keen to explore ways to actually create fractures and fissures in trees. I know in the UK, when they create habitats for bats, they put sticks of dynamite down the ends of branches to blow them open, to fracture them. Coronet pruning, some of those sorts of things. So where we can do it, I'm happy to light a fuse.
I was thinking of buildings and things and bridges and stuff like that.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think it's incredibly important, and it's great to see some of our sort of, peregrine falcons that nest on our tall buildings and some of those sorts of things. So, yeah.
Sarah Beckesy, who was involved in the book that Ian put up before, when she talks about everyday nature and renaturing our cities, she has some great examples of building design that are incorporating hollows and birds within the buildings. It's quite amazing, her presentation. One quick question.
Thank you, Ian. The urban forest strategy has been very popular amongst other municipalities, who've incorporated their own forest strategies. A concern that I have is that when we saw the earlier maps of Melbourne, how Melbourne was, the trees, the forest, is in the south and the east, not in the north and the west. North and the west is grassland. So my question to you is, how closely did you examine the natural landscape that was here before the city was here, and how did that inform your urban forest strategy? The things in City of Melbourne, it's quite different because it's so built up compared to other municipalities, but I'm seeing it not be properly considered, the natural landscape be properly considered in other municipalities.
It's a really good question, and I think probably just to summarise quickly, and why I stressed we need to imagine and realise a future forest for the city. We can't obviously go back to pre-settlement vegetation, that's all changed. And I think the stresses and the environment, climate change, is really forcing us to think more broadly for species selection and success, and the many, many things that we need trees and green infrastructure to do. In terms of the work that we've done, we've really tried to look at the ecology of the city. So we're looking at soils, slope, water patterns, the natural assets of the landscape, and trying to bring those back to life. And there's sort of many, many sort of great examples. We're trying to increase permeability as much as we are increasing canopy cover, so peeling back and allowing the natural processes to come through. And you know, simple things. There was a species of tree planted, I think it was Palmerston Street in Carlton, and it died. And we went out and had a look and trying to figure out why, and this delightful old gentleman walked past and goes, "Oh, it just drowned. When I was a kid, there was a creek down here." So there's an enormous amount that we can learn from the past and be guided for how we do things into the future. And understanding the ecology and the nature of the place that you're in is incredibly important. And I think for other cities, we can learn a lot, we can exchange a lot, but what's incredibly important is that you create a recipe for the land that you're in and how you look after it and how we can be stewards for the future. How can we learn from 60,000 years of governance and management and take the learnings from that to guide what we do in the future is really important. So the ecology of the place in all its aspects, the spirit of the place, is incredibly important for us as we imagine that future.
Thank you, Ian. Please thank Ian.
Just the parent handover. Charlie's father's off to the Melbourne Festival, and so now Charlie's come to join us. Charlie was at the Bio Blitz on Sunday, so she knows all about it and knows all about her mum's fear of birds. No. But it's great that she has turned up, because I would like to acknowledge, Dean, that actually Charlie's kinder room is called the Wambawani room. And so it's really lovely that they're actually incorporating a lot of Aboriginal words and language in their learning. But it's really great when Charlie says, "I'm in the Wambawani room." When you mentioned it before, that was great. I think now on the program, I'm conscious that we're about to hear from Rod about a bit more about urban ecology, but I'm conscious that we have been sitting for a little while. I'm not sure about you, but if you'd like to stand up to stretch your legs, please do. Not even if you'd like, let's do it. Let's all stand up. And I know that Dean talked about frogs and frog calls and the cacophony. I'm not going to ask you all to do a frog call. However, you know, if anyone out there would like to give us a bird call, you know, maybe. Is any birders in the audience that would like to give... Karen is now thinking about her favourite bird call. Okay. Hand up, who'd like to give us their favourite bird call? No, come on, Karen, you're going to have to now. You can all sit down except for Karen, who's going to give us her bird call. Oh, good. Thank you very much. So I would now like to introduce our next speaker, which is Dr. Rodney Van Der Ree, who is the senior ecologist at the City of Melbourne. He has a PhD in landscape and wildlife ecology from Deakin University, where he studied the impacts of the loss and fragmentation of habitat on hollow-dependent wildlife. And Rod's going to talk about managing and planning for tree hollows in the City of Melbourne. Welcome to the stage.
Thank you very much. And it's a hard act to follow after someone who can do bird calls. I'm the senior ecologist at the City of Melbourne, and part of my job was to finish off this Nature in the City strategy and start to roll it out. And one of the things that we're focusing on in that is the wildlife. And, you know, good things take time. That's why tonight's, we didn't tell you this, but it's actually a four-hour seminar. So some things take decades, some are centuries, and I should have had a millennial thing in there acknowledging the traditional owners. But there's a storm brewing. It's a perfect storm situation happening in Melbourne at the moment. We've heard a bit that, you know, we've got a few old trees. There's a couple that are over a couple of hundred years old. This one, River Red Gum, Separation Tree Botanic Gardens, no longer alive, was vandalised a couple of times over the past few years. We've heard about the corroboree tree in St Kilda. So there's very, very few trees that are over 200 years old. Most of our oldest trees are actually 100, 120 years old. Some of those were naturally sort of grown or were specifically planted by us, as I said, in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Some of those are in parks like Royal Park. Some of the sugar gums that were planted I learnt at the Hollow Blitz a couple of nights ago that there's a ring of sugar gums that had fencing around it, and that was specifically to keep the stock out so that the white people could have a picnic in the grass without getting trampled by the stock. And then, of course, you've got parks and streets, so University Square or along Royal Parade and places like that where we've got 100-year-old elm trees. We recognise, as Ian pointed out, that some of our trees are naturally dying, so we've got a target at the moment of planting 3,000 trees annually across the city. We've been doing that for the past 5 years. It's a very ambitious program. And just to put some of the natural tree decay and dying into perspective, overall, over the next 20 years, approximately 40% of our trees in the public realm, that's in streets and parks, are likely to die a natural death, if you like. This is compounded, though, by things that we don't quite plan for. So trees collapsing, trees breaking, and essentially, ecologists love what foresters hate. So when we see things like this, we see beauty. But foresters, they see decay and they see defects. So it's another way of looking at things, and we tend to be, as ecologists, a little more sort of, you know, inclusive and all-embracing. You know, a bit more balanced in some way. Anyway, so when we see these sorts of trees, there are, and I'll try and get the right point here. So we see a crack here. This could be habitat for insectivorous bats. So some of these bats are really small. They can fit inside those cracks. You've got a trunk here. And these are all within the city of Melbourne, I would point out. So this is a tree that, from an urban forest perspective, if this was along a street, we would be removing it within a flash because of the risk that it poses to life and property. And so again, this is one of those sugar gums in Royal Park. You know, a really old tree, lots of decay, but it provides really, really important resources for hollow-dependent species. And of course, there's a constant pressure to remove trees as well. So this is a map showing the Melbourne Metro project. So it's you know, really important infrastructure for the city, but we need to remove trees in order to build this thing. And we've also got other developments. So lots of buildings being developed in here. Now, very foolishly here, I have covered up my legend. So one colour means things that are currently under construction. One of them is things that are approved for construction, and one is things that are proposed for construction. Does anyone else know what the colours mean? Specific. Anyway, anything in yellow, blue or green are buildings that are going to be built soon. There you go. So we manage trees primarily for risk and tree health. As I said, and as Ian pointed out, it's about minimising the risk to life and property, particularly along streets and in parks where people are sitting around having picnics. And so what we do is we prune the trees. We remove the trees as required to minimise the damage to those trees and the defects and so on because of those reasons. One of the, as we were writing Nature in the City strategy, we came across some work that people, a guy called Darren LaRue in Canberra, he's done a lot of work in Canberra itself looking at tree hollows and use of tree hollows by wildlife. And he found that over time, so this is a graph showing the number of hollow-bearing trees per hectare on the y-axis and the x-axis is time, that over time along the streets there's going to be a decline in the number of hollow-bearing trees that are going to be obviously available for wildlife. Along the streets. In bushland, it's not so bad. It's going to be, you know, there's some ups and downs over time, but it's still relatively steady. And this is based on information about the number of trees they have, the size of those trees, and the natural decay and collapse of trees in Canberra. I would point out, though, that in a natural sort of woodland setting, the average number of large hollow-bearing trees per hectare is actually 20. So even though Canberra, they're talking 5 hollow-bearing trees and declining to, you know, maybe 1, it's already a quarter of what it should be in a natural setting. For Melbourne, though, we're not sure what our trajectory is looking like, and that's the whole purpose of the hollow blitz, and that's why we're out there counting hollows and looking for animals using them. One possibility is that this red trajectory is the one that we're on, and we've got a certain number of hollow-bearing trees here. We don't know what the number is, and maybe it's going to go down to zero. Maybe it's going to be a much more gradual decline, or maybe if we do it properly, we can actually halt that decline at some point and then increase the trajectory back up. The challenge we have, though, is we don't know how many trees we currently have with hollows. We don't know what the time frame is going to be over which that natural decay is going to happen. And while we'd like to get to that green line and the upwards trajectory, we don't really know at this point in time how to get there. So the things we're thinking about for managing trees in the city, we need to know the number of trees and their size and something about their age. We need to know the number of trees with hollows, the number of hollows per tree, what the size of those hollows are, because, you know, if you're a big fat possum, you can't fit in a little hole that's good for bats. And bats go in the little holes because the possums can't get in there. You know, if you're a little animal, you're not going to be in a hole that a powerful owl might be in for obvious reasons. We need to understand a bit about the current and potential use of hollows by wildlife. We need to understand information about their lifespan of the urban trees in Melbourne. So then we can go and predict the abundance, the future supply of hollows, and then what sort of things we need to do going forward to ensure we've got enough hollow trees in the city. Luckily, Melbourne has one of the most comprehensive and one of the first urban forest inventories around. We've got about 77,000 trees in the city. We know what their size is because we've measured the trunk diameter, and from that we've got a bit of information about their age. We're beginning to get information about the number of trees with hollows. So based on our tree maintenance program, we've got a little bit of information about that, but it's not a complete set. We've got a bit of information about the current use of hollows, so Wildlife Victoria, Wildlife Care, and Wildlife Care Group. We've got information from them about where they're finding or getting reports of animals to be rescued. And from that, we can, and if it's a chick, we can kind of infer that if that was a chick in a certain park, then presumably that chick was, and it's hollow requiring species, that presumably it was a nest in a hollow in a tree in that park. But it's, you know, it's anecdotal, it's patchy information. Bit of information about the lifespan of urban trees. We have no idea at the moment about what the abundance and future supply will be, nor what the best mix, the optimal mix of different strategies to ensure we get hollows, sufficient hollows of the right size, the right location across the city. But the Citizen Forester Program, which I'll touch on in a minute in a bit more detail, part of that program is about assessing every single one of the 77,000 trees in the city and figuring out which ones have hollows and which ones don't. The current and potential use of hollows by wildlife, that's what this hollow blitz is all about. We need to know which species are using which trees in the city, where they're using those hollows, so that we can plan for the future better. And once we get all this information together, then we can start to answer what the future supply, what is the trajectory of hollows in trees for Melbourne, and then we can start making concrete plans about where those hollows should be placed, which trees should have them, etc., etc. The Citizen Forester Program, it's for volunteers. We've got a few hundred in this program doing a whole bunch of different data collection exercises across the city. Really important. If you're interested in being involved, that's the website there. But if you just put in Citizen Forester, City of Melbourne, you'll get to the right page. And then the Hollow Blitz. So I know quite a number of you were involved on the weekend just past, but there's another one on the 3rd and 4th of November, and basically we're going in five different parks across the city and looking to see what animals are using different hollows. And this one here is this one here. Now, isn't that a perfect reason to get out there and look at hollows? And Karen, I mean, how can anybody not love a bird?
Exactly. And it's not a regular orchid.
It's not a rainbow muckrake. So this is a galah in a hole. And I must point out, this is one of my little sort of bragging moments. People have been looking at this thing for about, 2 hours on the first night, 2 hours on the second night. And when I was looking at it, there were two chicks that came out. So. Anyway, so thank you very much. Yes, yeah, we're recording all sorts of information about the use of those specific hollows.
Is anyone here part of our citizen forester teams? Team? Thank you. Obviously, we got David and Kelly very involved in coordinating those groups. So thank you for being involved, and certainly the information that we get from our citizen science programs, be that the BioBlitz, our citizen foresters, or the information we'll get from this hollow blitz are essential. Hi, Charlie. Sorry. Does anyone have a quick question for Rod? We've got time for a one or two. Yep.
No man is an island, and neither is a council. So, you know, knowing where all the hollows are in the city of Melbourne, that like, is there information being correlated by surrounding councils? Because obviously, there would be species, if they couldn't find a hollow, you know, they're not like people that pay council rates, they're not.
That's right.
Yeah, they're going to go to another council and they can find a hollow. I was just interested to know if there's any information coming from other councils around.
So I can't speak definitively for other councils, but as far as I'm aware, there's no sort of systematic surveys of hollows in other councils, but once we've developed the framework, it's certainly able to be adopted elsewhere and great idea.
Thank you. I'm actually interested about the developments, I mean the buildings and skyscrapers. It's not reversible. So however ugly they are in the city, they are there. So is there any strategy, any policy to kind of enforce some practice of growing green spaces? Particularly on the rooftop, we know there are tons of land on the rooftop, but they would not have calculated how heavy the soil, the water would need to be carried. So they aren't developed to carry the green spaces. Is there any development, research, or whatever to help that?
There is a major green infrastructure program that includes green roofs, walls, facades, the whole, you know, gamut of green options. You're right, older buildings aren't necessarily designed to take, you know, the soil volume and the weight of things. But when there's new buildings being developed, green infrastructure is part of what is required in those buildings. So increasingly, new buildings will have green infrastructure associated with them. And in some of those buildings, it'll include publicly accessible green open space. But I'm looking forward to the day where we have forests on the roof with tree hollows and 200-year-old trees. maybe. But
I like the vision. Like the vision, and it's why we're really glad that we've got urban ecologists like Rodney and Lee and in our team, so that the visions that you have will hopefully become a reality. But thank you very much, Rodney. We now have one. Oh, I'll do the slides first. I'm not sure what you're doing, Charlie, in the back there. Okay, now to round out our conversation, we've learned about why birds are great. And I do love birds, really. The rainbow bee eater is my favourite bird. We've heard about birds, the importance of knowing what was here before all the buildings and the construction came, and even more importantly, the Aboriginal knowledge that was and still is and will be in our city. We've learnt a lot about what the City of Melbourne is up to and what we're doing around our urban forest, but also with biodiversity and in particular around the hollows and this bio blitz around the hollow blitz. But now our final presenter will, sort of round it out and get us to think about other actions that we can take, not just as a city, but as as citizens within our community? What can we do, not just for the birds, for the bugs that we've heard about, not just for the trees, but other biodiversity projects and programs and that the city is involved in, could be involved in, you could be involved in. And so to introduce our final speaker, I have here that to Dr. Lindy Lumsden is a principal research scientist at the Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning, is based at the Arthur Ryler Institute, the department's biodiversity research institute. And Lindy's been conducting ecological research on mammals for 35 years and specialises in research on the ecology of insect-eating bats and their conservation requirements, as well as research on other threatened species such as leadbeater possums. And Lindy is conducting applied ecological research to develop practical solutions to management problems. Tonight, as I've said already, Lindy's talking about what action people can take and how to get yourself involved, and scientific evidence also about what we know. So thank you, Lindy, for rounding out our conversation.
Everybody, just like Karen's passionate about birds, I'm passionate about bats. Now, how could you resist the cheesy, smiley, grin face on the bat there? So this is the Gould's wattle bat, and that's probably the most common species of bat in Melbourne, and probably more common than most other things in Melbourne. Okay, what I'm going to talk about is just just a little bit on why some of our big trees with hollows are important, and particularly for bats, which are a group that Rodney's mentioned it a bit, but compared to the big hollows that things like brushies and lorikeets and galahs need, what bats need are tiny hollows. So this is a very typical Gould's wattle bat roost here, where we've got a dead spout on a big live red gum in this case, and that could have 20 or 30 Gould's wattle bats roosting in that. And this crack here is a typical maternity site for a lesser long-eared bat, and they like roosting in dead trees, so some species dead trees, some species live trees, and that had 36 females and their young coming just out of that crack. So when you're thinking about hollows, think about the tiny hollows as well. They can be equally as important. And because our bats are so tiny, this is a fully grown little forest bat, which you see from the size of my thumb. Not very big, 4 grams, less than the weight of a 10-cent piece, and so they're using tiny hollows. They'll often use borer holes, insect borer holes in trees. So hollows, virtually all of our species of insect-eating bats in Victoria depend on tree hollows, so they're critically important. So it's so important to protect both live hollow-bearing trees and also dead hollow-bearing trees, and one way of doing that is, instead, where there is a tree that is an issue for human safety, instead of, this is an example not in Melbourne but up in northern Victoria, and this tree was obviously branches like this hanging out over the road. Instead of cutting down the whole tree, which it's a magnificent big old tree, what they did was just lop all of these branches off here. So it left some nice little hollows that, bat-sized hollows that bats could go into, and it meant that that tree was then safe, it could be retained. Now, there's other things that can be done, if there's a bike path or something underneath, whether it's possible to redirect bike paths around so that you're not within the fall zone, or plant out a whole lot of an area underneath a tree so that, restricts people walking in those areas. Because these trees, as has been mentioned, you can't replace these trees easily. They take hundreds of years, and so we've got to hang on to them as much as possible. And even when a big live tree's got to come down for various reasons, the more you can keep of the live tree standing, even if the tree does die, the better. So if you can keep extra branches, they can provide perches for things and form hollows over the years. This was a massive elm tree in the UK, but the same could apply with elm trees here. And so what they were doing were cutting the branches off and leaving these coronet cuts, which mimic more branches breaking off rather than just a sharp cut. And so there's more likely to be hollow formation, and it just leaves more of the tree left for biodiversity to use. Now, the most critical thing is to retain hollow-bearing trees, but sometimes that's not going to be enough, and we need to come up with some alternative approaches to be able to put more hollows back in our landscapes. And the classic way of doing that's nest boxes, which has already been mentioned a bit, and there's a whole range of different designs and materials, whether it's the early ones often just with plywood or getting thicker timber, and also some big recycled plastic ones now, and Dan Harley from Zoos Vic uses those extensively for Leadbeater's possums. And there's different designs, you know, Leadbeater's likes a big chamber with a small hole up at the top, often, you know, birds the hole up the top. Bats always like going up, so bats have a slit at the bottom so that they can go up. Animals can take their nesting material in, things like the sugar glider with leaves to make a nice little nest in them. Now, there's a few critical things to know about nest boxes. Some recent work we've been doing and with Steve Griffiths from La Trobe University, looking at even simple things like the colour that you paint the nest boxes. Often nest boxes get coloured the dark green colour, so they blend in a lot more. But that can massively impact on the temperature within the boxes. And Steve was finding, so this is ambient temperature, the red line here, and then if it was a light green, if it was a white box, it was pretty close to ambient. If it was a light green box, it got hotter during the day. If it was a dark green box, on average, it could get up to about 60 degrees hotter during the day. And on really hot days, in the sort of extreme situation of a dark green box facing west, getting that westerly sun, he was finding the box inside, the temperature was getting up to 53 degrees on a day that was only 31 degrees. So, you know, it can have a massive impact. So the dark green boxes probably, you know, aren't the best colour to paint the boxes. And with boxes, you need to consider a range of things. You know, it's not just put it up and forget. You've got to do maintenance on the boxes. You know, they can get damaged, rot, or a branch falls on them, or the lid comes off. And with the bat boxes, at least, bird boxes might get, you know, feral species in them. What the bat boxes tend to get is ants. And so, you know, if you've got it full of ants, then the bats aren't going to be able to use it. So, and the way that get rid of the ants is by putting talcum powder in there. You don't want to put chemicals in there at all because that would affect the bats. But talcum powder and just leaving the door open can get rid of ants. Another thing to consider is that bats will shift their roost site regularly, so they'll have multiple roost sites that they move around on a regular basis, and so just putting up one box isn't going to be enough. You need to put up multiple boxes so that they've got that option of moving around. And also another thing that we've just been working on a lot recently is that sometimes you only get common species using the boxes, or it's dominated by common species. So Gould swaddle bats, most common species in Melbourne, most of the bat boxes in Melbourne are dominated by Gould swaddle bats. About 90% of the animals we get in bat boxes are Gould swaddle bats, of the bats we get. And so what we're doing some work on at the moment is trying to see how much other species can use them, whether it's just dominated by that species, whether, you know, it's increasing the numbers, or and what other species are doing. So it's not a universal panacea for a tree hollow. You know, you might only get a couple of common species rather than getting the full suite of species. And we might need to design different things to try and cater for all species. Now, there's a lot of information around about nest boxes. The West Gippsland CMA has got a bat box kit that explains a lot of details on where to put boxes, how to put them up. There's Melbourne's Bat Box Monitoring Program website that's got a huge amount of information that's really useful. La Trobe Uni Wildlife Sanctuary sells boxes, but lots of other people sell boxes as well, or you can make them yourself. They do need to be put up reasonably high and get them away from cats and that sort of thing, but these have got lots and lots of information on that. Now, there's all sorts of other types of hollows that we can do as well. So sometimes if a tree's got to come down that's got an existing hollow, for example, in the photo I showed before, if this tree had to come down, you know, retain that bit of timber and attach it to another tree. At least something might be able to use it. If you've, if it's already got the hollow in it, something might be able to use it. But we're also looking at constructing log hollows. So, and this is where if it's a solid bit of wood that's been felled and cut it in half, cut the middle out, put it back together and put a hole in it and then attach it up to a tree. And again, with Steve, we've been looking at what the temperature is, because in nest boxes, the temperature varies hugely. This is the temperature of a natural hollow here. Nest box fluctuates widely. This is over a 24-hour period. Whereas these log hollows, the temperature matches a bit more closely to a natural hollow, which is what we're trying to get. Now, another method is actually, you know, cutting using a chainsaw to cut a hollow in a tree, and that's going to be the quickest way of doing it. Rodney mentioned, you can use dynamite to blow off the end of a tree. I think that's a little bit drastic, but it's been suggested. But it's really interesting. You know, a whole lot of us have started looking at chainsaw hollows all about the same time, looking at different species, and so it's something that's really taking off at the moment, which is great. And it's being trialled for a range of things. You might have heard in the media about the swift parrots, putting in hollows for swift parrots in Tassie. And Steve and others have got a project on sugar gliders and bats in the Mornington Peninsula where we're creating tree hollows. And this is one for bats where we've got a slit, a bit like the slit that the lesser long-eared bats use, that sort of opens up a bit more to give a space for bats. And if we look back at this graph, this is what a natural hollow looks like temperature-wise, and there's two lines there. That's what our artificial chainsaw hollows look like as well. So they're much closer mimicking the temperature within a natural hollow. So the work I've been doing recently on Leadbeater's possum, and I know Leadbeater's aren't, in the city of Melbourne, but it's just to give you an idea of what the possibilities are using this technique. And Leadbeater's depends on hollows, but hollows take a long time to form. And while the hollows are declining, we need to be able to supplement the natural ones. And they like an internal cavity with a small entrance, and this is work we're doing in conjunction with an arborist, Mark Cashmore, and it's also a project with Vic Forest. So we're designing the hollow using a chainsaw to cut a slot in the tree, form a cavity inside with the chainsaw through the slot, leaving a small a slot which we then put a door, a prefab hardwood door, that just leaves this nice little small hollow up the top. And we've put in 72 of those hollows, and we've been monitoring them every 4 months for the last couple of years. And again, the arborist goes up the tree and uses a little boroscope light to look in, and we're looking for the nesting material that Leadbeater's take into the nest to insulate them, and also look to see whether there's animals in there, and we set cameras at them as well. And yay, it worked, success. Over half of our hollows now have been occupied by Leadbeater's possums, and sometimes we can get a whole lot in a single hollow. This is in a really small tree. This is five individuals emerged from this hollow over a 4 minute period. So fantastic. And we know they can breed in the hollows. We've got photos of animals with a young on their back, sometimes animals with twins on their back, and how they duck into that small hole without getting knocked off, I don't know, but they seem to manage. And we're getting observations of the nest building behaviour, where they strip bits of bark and curl it up in their tail to go into the hollow. So this is a sequence where it's taking in nesting material into the hollow. Yes. So we've had half of the hollows used by Leadbeater's, but we've also had a whole lot of the others used by other species, whether it be sugar gliders, some birds, white-throated tree creeper, little Andechinus down the bottom here. So 88% of hollows have been used by some animal. And so it shows that where there's a shortage of hollows, you put in a hollow and they'll move in quickly. So how can you get involved in things? So there's citizen science projects, and Rod's talked about the hollow blitz one. If anybody's interested in working on bats, we have these monthly bat box checks out at Wilson Reserve in Ivanhoe, or Organ Pipes out in out near Calder. And again, this website on our Melbourne's monitoring program gives you all the information on that. And there's other citizen science programs, this one called Hollows as Homes, that's run out of Sydney, but it's trying to map where hollows are and what wildlife are using them. Now, if you come out on the bat box, you know, you get to join in and have the great fun of releasing bats at the end of the night, so it's fun. Now, if you want any further information at all, we've put together some fact sheets through the Australasian Bat Society. One includes on pruning trees to provide more bat hollows when trees do need to be pruned. There's other ones around just, you know, bats, the interesting things that they do, and bat boxes, and the fact that we need trees in our cities for bats. And also I've got a couple of the scientific papers on some of the work of the graphs I showed, if anybody's interested in any of those. So it's great to get involved. Our hollow-bearing trees are critically important. They're just so important. So tell all your friends and neighbours how important hollow-bearing trees are, and remember to keep any dead trees that you can, because they're fantastic for bats. So hollows are great. Let's keep our hollows, and we can do extra things as well. Okay, thank you.
Exciting. Have we got any questions for Lindy? David's got the microphone.
Just speak into it. Speak loudly.
Fantastic, great work.
It's been great doing experiments in the bush with creating artificial hollows. My concern is, though, with offset rules. For example, Big Forest now using lead beaters as a victory. Numbers going through the roof, apparently. Hello, we're there. Apparently, Vic Forest have saved lead beaters possums, which would be awesome if it was true. My other concern, though, is in the city with offsets, if you can put up a Gould's bat box, and we know it's only going to have Gould's wattle bats in it, the developer's going to use this to do more land clearing in urban areas or peri-urban areas where we've already got hardly anything left. Just like you to comment on that and tell me how you feel about these artificial boxes as offsets.
It's a really difficult one, because we want to try and do something to supplement, but we don't want the message to be, oh, you can just go and chainsaw a hollow now, and so you can go and cut down this hollow-bearing tree. Absolutely. What we try and say all the time is we're losing all our hollow-bearing trees. We can't afford to lose any more, but we've got to build up the numbers of hollows. So it shouldn't be an either-or, it should be an and. Now, that's a hard argument. You know, we can make it as often as we like, but, you know, there is the risk with this that it does get taken that way. And I want to stress to everybody, it needs to be seen as not, you know, a substitute for. And the Gould's wattle bat story is a really, you know, good one, and we've written a paper on this, that around the offset issue, in that if you're only getting a couple of really common species using your box, it's not a substitute for the tree hollows you've lost. Yes, it's good for those species, but it's not a true offset. And the paper we called it, is that nest boxes aren't a silver bullet, you know, and that they shouldn't be seen in an offsetting way as a substitute for hollows, because natural hollows, it's just so hard to replace them. So, yeah.
Thank you very much for your lovely talk. Somebody mentioned earlier about bats sometimes using artificial constructed surfaces, bridges, buildings, what have you. Have you seen much of that around in your surveys and studies in around Melbourne?
Yeah, it's interesting. So we get some species of bats that roost in tree hollows and they can use buildings as well. And then some species that roost in caves and mines and they'll use under bridges. And so they're different sorts of species. Now, under bridges, I haven't seen a lot of that in Melbourne. I don't know, Rodney, whether you have. No, shaking his head. Certainly in other places, they will use under bridges. And there's some fantastic examples in America, in Austin, Texas, where they've got this huge bridge and they sort of built bat roosting spots into it. And it's now a huge tourist attraction that there's about a million bats fly out from this bridge and everybody stands on top of the bridge, you know, watching. And it's a fantastic tourist attraction. Maybe we can do something like that in Melbourne. Good, yes. So, but I haven't seen that much here. Certainly in buildings, we get quite a few reports from people with bats using their buildings, and so some people want to get rid of them. We try and work with them to be able to convince them how beneficial the bats are to have around.
Why would they want to get rid of them?
Various reasons, because they just don't like the thought of bats being there. And when you show them a bat close up, you know, it'll often change people's minds. But it's the whole, you know, mystery media sort of thing on bats, which is really unfortunate. I've spent a lifetime trying to change people's attitudes on that. They do make a bit of noise occasionally. They do make, you know, a little bit of smell if there's a lot of them. But really, they don't cause a lot of damage. It's not like a rat chewing through wiring or anything. So the other reason people sometimes don't like it is if it comes to from the wall space to the inside of the house and flies around their head while they're asleep in bed. I actually think that's fantastic, but, you know, not everybody does. So it's those sorts of things, and that, you know, and often we'll be able to convince people to keep them when we say how good they are at catching mosquitoes and other insects and whatever. But sometimes people do. So there are reports, and we're always interested to hear of reports of in Melbourne with bats in people's roofs. So
time for one more question over here.
Thanks for a great talk, Lindy. As part of my role for Hume City Council, I go in and do biodiversity audits in school grounds. And one of the aspects that we measure is habitat trees. And obviously a lot of schools chop down trees because of the risk that it poses. So we propose that they put in nest boxes, but then the issue becomes they become habitat for sparrows and common miners, etc. So I did consider promoting microbat boxes as an alternative that you're creating habitat. Is there a risk factor in doing that within a school ground?
So by risk, are you talking about disease risk? So the only diseases that microbats can give to people are lyssavirus, which is the rabies-like virus, which you've got to get bitten. So it can't be transmitted through urine or dropping or close proximity. So as long as, you know, if there was the only way that there could be, and lyssavirus is incredibly, incredibly rare. So, you know, it's probably one in a billion chance that the bat might be there, but it can kill you. So we have to take it seriously. But as long as it was really, it was put up high that the kids couldn't get to, and because they're hidden during the day and it's just on dusk that they're coming out, if you put it away, you know, so that there's no droppings falling onto where the kids, I mean, there's nothing more in the droppings of bat droppings than there is in possum or anything else. But as long as it's really stressed that if anybody happened to find a bat that was on the ground, not to handle it because of the minuscule risk of lyssavirus, then there's no risk at all. So it'd be great to encourage bats, yeah.
Thank you very much, Lindy.
I'll just leave those there in case anybody wants to look.
If you're putting in nest boxes and miners and stuff,
that's a good example of how we've probably got a few minutes at the end. I know we're conscious it's coming up on 8 o'clock and people need to go, but that if you do have further questions or want to seek some advice from our experts, they might have, you know, 10 or so more minutes. So please come to the front and ask questions. But that is the end of our amazing Hollow Blitz seminar, and thank you so much for coming along. And I've learnt a lot, I assume, and hope that you've learnt a lot as well, and have been inspired by what we're trying to do in the city, you know, and not only about increasing our canopy, but understanding what else we can do to increase biodiversity in our city. And I'm really proud of what the team does, and I hope that if you're a resident, a visitor, a business owner in our city, you're also proud of what we're doing here as well. I would like to obviously thank Lee for coordinating tonight and putting together this great presentation. And she's holding some bags with some gifts for our fabulous speakers. So you'll receive a copy of our Little Things That Run the City book and a beautiful cup from Mick Harding, I believe, is the Aboriginal Artist Cup. That's beautiful. So thank you so much. And let's do thank our speakers again. I, you know, pulled together this slide in that last 1 minute there. So, but if you haven't signed up to a Hollow Blitz already, please, you can look at the Participate Melbourne website via our website. And also, if you aren't involved in our Citizen Forester team, they're always looking for more volunteers, and it's just extraordinary what the data that they collect for us, incredibly important program. So please get involved in that. I said before, I was very proud of our team, and I would like to acknowledge that we've not only got Lee here, and we've obviously heard from Ian and Rod, but Kelly's here tonight, and David, and Dan, and Vanessa, and Fiona, and I'm sure I've missed out on a whole lot of people, but thank you so much to our Urban Sustainability team for coming along tonight and all that you do for our urban forest. I think they all deserve a round of applause. And obviously, thank you for coming out tonight. And I know that you're all involved, not all, but all of you maybe, but a lot of you are involved in community groups, friends of groups, organisations that do a considerable effort for sustainability in our city. So I'd also like to thank you and have a good evening and see you at another Hollow Blitz. Thank you.